Stephen Main is the founder of crikey.com.au. He's a shareholder activist and our commentator here on Mornings Weekly on what's going on in the world of business and finance. Good morning, Stephen.
Hi, Deborah.
Let's talk about the Reserve Bank and the strength of the dollar. It's all very interconnected.
Well, it is. I think the two factors that have driven the dollar to its 25-year high of 98 cents were the surging commodity prices and the fact that Australia has the second highest interest rates in the developed world after New Zealand. And the prospect of a sudden backflip by the Reserve Bank, where the discussion about further rate increases has disappeared almost overnight, it seems, and now we're talking about potentially a half percentage point cut next month, plus a very sudden drop in commodity prices. I mean, you have to remember here, this has been the biggest ever cut in the oil price. It's gone from 146 to 116 in just the space of a few weeks. So, bang, the dollar's lost 10 cents in a month and has gone from 98 to a low of 88 yesterday. And obviously with the 63 pages of discussion coming out from the Reserve Bank yesterday, there's a whole range of takeouts from that, one of which is that they're forecasting inflation to keep going higher. So they're now saying that by December it could hit 5%. Which is a pretty amazing thing. We may, for the first time in many, many years in Australia, see inflation being higher than unemployment, because at the moment, unemployment is only officially 4.3%. And I've heard Alan Kohler say that this could be the first statistically full employment recession, because now more than half the workforce are casuals, contractors, small businesses, that the way this recession will, or this slowdown, I should say, will play out is not in a huge increase in the official unemployment numbers, but rather a lot of people getting less shifts, having less work, and just suffering their slowdown through that, but not full-time employees actually being retrenched in that traditional way when we see economic slowdowns.
Now, the Reserve Bank has a comfort zone for the inflation rate.
They do. I mean, they target to get between 2 and 3%, and they're well outside that band now. We're up pushing 4%, and now even yesterday's figures, they're predicting that it will go even higher. So yesterday we had inflation up, and we had the growth forecasts down. So growth is now forecast to be, by the December quarter of this year, it will only be 2%. And when you consider that we've already had 0.7% of growth in the first quarter, the Reserve Bank is basically saying we're only going to have insipid growth of 1.3% over the remaining 9 months of the quarter, and that means we'll probably have a quarter where we go backwards or we have negative. And once we see that, the effect on the psyche is quite stark, because then you get all this talk about recession where you get two quarters of negative growth. So I think that the Reserve Bank is basically admitting there's been a very sharp slowdown. There's been an incredible collapse of confidence in Australia, and the stock market falling 25%, things like that is really hurting. And so they are getting ready for some significant cuts in interest rates to avert a recession, if that's what they need to do. And if inflation ticks up to 5% at the peak, well, they're prepared to wear that, because I think over time they can see that commodity prices are coming off, and that is easing some of the inflationary fears when oil suddenly does collapse by $30.
Now, at the same time, you know, you paint that interesting picture of an economy that's really very divided. There's lots of people, as you say, working casually in small businesses, taking shifts, being takers rather than being in a position of strength when they negotiate for their wages and other conditions. In the political sphere, this means that the economy becomes incredibly the way that you pull the levers becomes very difficult.
Well, it's a unique set of challenges that I think that the Reserve Bank and the Rudd government faces. I mean, an unprecedented global credit crunch. And you know, Australia's got $620 billion of foreign debt, and we're having to pay a lot more for that because of the global credit crunch. So the Reserve Bank has some exquisite challenges to try and wrestle with. Obviously, they don't want a recession, but their targeting is all about keeping inflation under control. And I think there's a few things you can say about the way that the government has handled it so far. I think that the $7 billion of tax cuts that just came through, which a lot of people argued were reckless and inflationary, are now seen as a very sensible cushioning for an economy which is dramatically slowed. It's ironic, I think, also, that the two things really still holding up growth in Australia at the moment are mining exports, the commodities boom, which we all know about, but the Reserve Bank also identified public spending on infrastructure as the second big factor yesterday, which is driving the economy. And you have to remember that that actually is basically state governments borrowing net more than $20 billion a year to go on an unprecedented investment program for infrastructure. And for states to be borrowing like that in the middle of a credit crunch is also, I think, a little bit of a challenging thing for policymakers to wrestle with, because debt is the thing that is causing the scourge around global markets. And we have too much household debt of $1 trillion. We have mortgages at $850 billion, foreign debt at $620 billion, and now we've got states borrowing well over $20 billion a year to fund this this enormous public infrastructure spending. So very, very difficult challenges to weigh up.
Now, in the midst of all this swirl are, of course, the banks. I wonder if they ever really lose. Westpac has, you say, just moved past National Australia Bank's market capitalisation.
Yes, well, back in 1992, when Westpac almost went broke and they declared a loss of $1.6 billion, everyone was saying then that the hero of the big banks was National Australia Bank, based in Melbourne, which didn't get into trouble with all the entrepreneurs. And 16 years on from that moment, last Thursday we had quite a historic day when Westpac's market valuation went past National Australia Bank's valuation for the first time in well over 20 years. So poor old NAB has now been relegated to number three of our big banks, and the Commonwealth Bank, which was reporting a much-anticipated profit tomorrow, is still worth $60 billion, which is an incredible performance for our biggest bank. And Westpac comes in at number two with $46 billion, and then NAB is a distant third at $43.5 billion. So there's been a real change in the pecking order in Australian banks, where we've now got the two Sydney-based banks as the dominant banks, and ironically we have the new National Australia Bank CEO Cameron Klein is going to live in Sydney, which is so it's a real shifting of the financial centre of Australia to Sydney. And I'd argue that our banks are incredibly strong for this global credit crisis. And the Westpac statement last week, basically updating the market that they had very little bad debt problems at all, has seen their shares surge by more than 5% in 3 days, and we're expecting to see a similarly strong and upbeat result from the Commonwealth Bank tomorrow. So we suffer the world's most expensive banking system, consumers get ripped off by our banks, but they are very strong, and by and large they have really avoided this global credit crisis particularly well, especially the Sydney-based banks.
Well, it's interesting to think about Sydney becoming the banking capital of Australia when, as you say, it really has been something that I've associated with those sandstone buildings in Melbourne. Is Westpac's preeminence over NAB principally due to the St George acquisition?
Well, I think the St George acquisition will be the crowning glory for Westpac and its return. I mean, it was the biggest bank before it almost went broke in the early 1990s. It basically learnt the lesson about don't be reckless with your lending. And Bob Joss and David Morgan, the two CEOs who've steered the bank for the last 15 years, have been very prudent and have been very cautious, just as David Murray, the Commonwealth Bank CEO for 13 years, was extremely cautious. And they didn't take risks that they shouldn't have taken. So Westpac, when they do consummate the St George takeover, they might actually just go past Commonwealth Bank in terms of being the biggest bank by market value. So the two banks there in Martin Place in Sydney are both going to be worth around the $60 billion mark once Westpac swallows St George, and that's pretty huge and it's pretty strong, and it's a real concentration of power up there in Martin Place.
Now, meanwhile, everybody's watching what's going on with fund management and financial engineers, and Babcock and Brown is the company that's been most in the spotlight. Where does it sit right now?
Well, I guess you had the three companies which emerged as the Macquarie mini-me's. So Macquarie Bank pioneered this model of listed infrastructure funds, and then we saw Orco and MFS on the Gold Coast and Babcock all come out and try and sort of copy the Macquarie model, and I guess progressively they're all falling by the wayside, and yesterday it was a great day of ignominy for Babcock, because all year they've been saying that we're going to make at least $750 million in net profit this year. And they said it, you know, first said it in February, they said it again on June 25, they said it at the AGM on May 31, and they're basically deluding themselves, because the market for their funds has been crashing around them, and everyone knows there's a global real estate correction going on, and Babcock & Brown has huge real estate investments. And the bank seemed to think that it could pull off a sale of a few wind farms in Europe and declare a $500 million profit from that, and then come up with this magical figure of what we've still made at least $750 million for the year. But what's happened is their auditors, Ernst & Young, have said, well, this wind farm stuff is actually, it's a pipe dream at the moment. You haven't done anything. And we have got to actually report the half-year results in a couple of weeks. And so we have the amazing situation yesterday of 6 weeks after the end of the financial year, and just a couple of weeks before they announced their half-year profit, Babcock has come out with a massive profit downgrade, but they've said it will fall by between 25 and 40%. So they still can't even put a precise figure on it, because they're waiting for their auditors to tell them exactly how much they have to write down the value of their carrying values for some of the investments in their funds and some of their property holdings. So it was a very interesting tale of increasingly alert and alarmed auditors in Australia, really reading the Riot Act to companies and forcing them to make write-downs that embarrass the company but protect the auditor from potential litigation down the track.
Now, this must have a devastating effect on expectations of investors in these companies who believed what they were told, that the profits would still roll in.
Well, I think the credibility of Babcock's management team, led by CEO Phil Green, has been hit. I mean, the press coverage today is fairly savage, and the stock fell 12% yesterday to $6. So it's a 7 week low, and markets like certainty. They like to be able to believe what management says. So when you have a management saying 5 days before the end of the financial year we're going to make at least $750 million, and then to come out a few weeks later and basically have this embarrassing backflip dictated to them by their auditors. And funds management is all about reputation, and I think Babcock is going to struggle to raise much more money from investors, because if you look at the performance of their various funds, they really have been some of the worst performed funds out there, and the whole empire is saddled up with almost $50 billion of debt. They really need to raise some equity and sell off a lot of assets, and I think they've suffered a pretty big blow, and I wouldn't want to be Phil Green in a couple of weeks declaring the profit results, because a lot of people have lost patience with what's happened there. And Macquarie Bank really has re-emerged as the preeminent financial engineering house in Australia, and a lot of their imitators are falling by the wayside.
Now, you're hearing the thoughts of Stephen Main. He's the founder of crikey.com.au. He's a shareholder activist. On the topic of sort of strange dealings, I guess. We covered the Bill Express collapse. This affected lots and lots of news agents, and it meant that people couldn't use EFTPOS and pay lots of bills through their news agents. Commander Communications fell over on Friday.
Yeah, so it's another small competitor of Telstra's in the sort of the telecommunications space. Falling over. Commander Communications was originally part of Telstra. It was spun out in 1998, and they provide a lot of communication services to small businesses. They have also big contracts with the federal government, and they collapsed, owing $300 million on Friday, and the banks are now in control trying to sell the business, and unsecured creditors are probably going to get nothing. So I guess there's a couple of lessons from this. The first one is it's very tough competing with Telstra in Australia. They are still the giant on the block. And the other one is that we've now seen 10 different companies have revealed that they will be making a loss of more than $100 million for 2007-2008. And if you go back and look at the last 4 years, there was only two companies that lost more than $100 million in 2006-2007, only two companies in 2005-2006, same again in 2004-2005, and even back in 2003-2004, there were only four companies that declared a loss of more than $100 million. So to reach the scale of red ink that we are currently seeing, you have to go back to 2002, 2003, when there were 11 companies that declared a loss of more than $100 million. And then the record, the all-time record, is 2001, 2002, when there were 15 companies that declared a loss of more than $100 million. That was coming out of the US recession and the dot-com crash. So seeing as we're still not even halfway through our profit reporting season, and we're seeing the likes of Commander and Bill Express falling over, I think it's fair to make the prediction at this point, Deborah, that we will have a record year for losses in Australia, and we're going to see many more companies join the likes of ABC Learning, Allco, Asciano, Commander, Centro, Hutchison, Toll Holdings, Tabcorp, announcing massive write-downs and losses as a result of the end of the credit crunch and the big correction on the market. So some companies will go broke, like Commander and Bill Express, and others will survive, but after they've had the embarrassment of big record-breaking losses, which will be a familiar theme in the coming weeks.
Stephen, can I just clarify the use of the word losses? When you talk about losses, are you talking about actual money, or is it a loss against a predicted profit? So the money, it was just like the managers dreamt up a bottom line they thought they could hit. They don't hit it, so they record a loss, but they're still solvent.
Well, they're still solvent because it's just an accounting loss. So it's what the accountants dictate you have to do, and I guess there's two contributors to that. There's what your operating performance is, and that often, you know, how much cash is coming in and going out. And then there's when you take write-downs on the valuations of your businesses. So, for instance, the reason that Toll Holdings will report a loss for the year is that in spinning off Virgin Blue, they are going to book a loss of $1.3 billion. In the case of ABC Learning, they've announced substantial write-downs, so they're going to deliver a loss. But in the case of Hutchison Telecommunications, it's just a cash flow thing. They're just a mobile phone business that's been losing more than $100 million for the last 6 years, and that's just a business that's losing money. So there's two elements. There's the operations of the business, and then there's the accounting write-downs. And the Babcock announcement yesterday was pretty much driven by the fact that they're going to be writing down the value of some real estate assets and some other investments. And I think it will be the write-downs which will be the big factor, where companies in Allco Finance claims at the moment to have net assets of $2.4 billion. The market says you've got closer to $100 million. So clearly they're going to have to write down a couple of billion dollars off their balance sheet, because their balance sheet has no bearing to reality in terms of what the market says Allco is worth, and that will drive the loss.
Stephen, thank you very much.
Thanks, Deborah.